11 days of fighting, hundreds of deaths, and finally a ceasefire emerges between Israel and Hamas, but the PR battle continues.
Hamas will claim that they saved Al-Aqsa, that they intervened and delivered powerful, painful, devastating blows to Israel.
Of course, Israel sees it differently. I'm Carol Hills. Also today, South Korea's president heads to the White House.
Most South Korean presidents try to tiptoe around the vortex of North Korea because it just sort of sucks you in and you never get out.
But not President Moon Jae-in. In Ireland, big excitement for bird watchers.
There's a long history of this bird in Ireland, so it's really exciting if they're going to come back and start to breed again.
Trust me, he's excited. Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. After 11 days of rockets and airstrikes, the fighting in Israel and Gaza may be coming to an end. On Thursday evening in Israel, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's security cabinet approved a unilateral ceasefire. That's according to Israeli media. Joining me now is The World's Ariel Osaran in Tel Aviv. Ariel, what does Israel say?
Well, overnight, there have been conflicting reports on the expected ceasefire, but Israeli military just announced that the cabinet unanimously agreed to the Egyptian-brokered ceasefire. And later on, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office confirmed that a truce has been reached. There's still no specific details on this. We don't know what it entails, what the sides agreed to, but at least there's an agreement to stop the violence. That's what we know at this point.
What about Hamas? Have they said anything?
Yeah, so just as the announcement from Israel came out, officials from the Hamas militant group said that a truce will come into effect at 2 a.m. local time. And officials in the group said this represents a Hamas victory over Israel, as they claim Israel agreed to stop its activities in the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah in East Jerusalem. There's no confirmation on the Israeli side for these claims, but this does seem to confirm that both sides have agreed to a ceasefire, like you said, after 11 days of devastating airstrikes and rocket fire.
Any indication whether Joe Biden made any difference here?
Well, the rhetoric from the Biden administration did definitely intensify today, and it's now clear, and it was clear for the Israelis throughout the day that time was running out. And it also came as Biden faced mounting pressure from within his own Democratic Party to reach an immediate ceasefire. In New York earlier today, the UN General Assembly convened to talk about fighting between Israel and Hamas. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said that if there's a hell on earth, it is the lives of children in Gaza. And if the truce holds, I believe the next step will be to rebuild Gaza, which is on the edge of a full-blown humanitarian crisis following heavy airstrikes in recent days. And as for Israel, they hope a subsequent agreement to this truce will ensure quiet on its southern border.
The World's Ariel Osaran in Tel Aviv. Thanks so much, Ariel.
Thanks, Carol.
At the end of the day, what exactly does Hamas want? The World's Sarah Birnbaum has more on that.
The Palestinian territories are divided physically between the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, but they're also divided politically. Since 2007, Hamas has been firmly in control of Gaza. It survived multiple rounds of war with Israel and a 14-year blockade. Hamas has thousands of fighters, an arsenal of rockets, and an extensive network of underground tunnels. So, what does Hamas want? Its 1988 charter says it wants the liberation of Palestine. Shibli Telhami, a fellow at the Brookings Institution, says Hamas wants to establish Muslim rule over the Holy Land.
Hamas, as an Islamist group, envisions that Palestine, all Palestine as they define it, meaning including what is now Israel, should be Palestinian. And when they talk about liberation, they talk about obviously controlling far more than the West Bank and Gaza.
Telhami says over time, though, Hamas has shown itself to be pragmatic. In the past, its leaders have agreed to temporary ceasefires with Israel, and the expectation is this will probably happen again. But at this moment, Telhami says, Hamas is looking for something specific.
one measure of victory for them is to get the Israeli to make some kind of concession on Jerusalem. For example, either in relation to the expulsion of Palestinians from their homes or some kind of measures related to Al-Aqsa Mosque. That's not likely to happen.
In any case, Hamas will claim victory when this current round of violence ends, says Hussein Ibish. He's with the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington.
Hamas will claim that they saved Al-Aqsa, that they intervened and delivered powerful, painful, devastating blows to Israel and taught the Zionists a lesson and stood up for truth and justice and mercy and God and Palestine and all good things.
The leaders of Hamas want something else. They want to unseat their Palestinian political rivals. And that's Fatah, the faction that dominates in the West Bank. In fact, Hussein Ibish says, this is what Hamas wants more than anything else.
Hamas' main aim has been to dominate the Palestinian national movement and control all self-ruled Palestinian territories. Like all political parties, its primary goal is political power within its own sphere.
Sadly, Ibish says violence serves this goal because Hamas can say it's leading the fight against Israel while Fatah stands by. But the conflict with Hamas in Gaza also benefits the Israelis, Ibish says, by feeding into their narrative.
Because it lets the Israelis say they have no partner. It lets them paint the Palestinian National Movement as a violent, dangerous terrorist threat. The settlements, therefore, then become a forward defense against a terrorist movement. So they have no choice but to defend themselves by building settlements and ultimately then by annexing territory. And for Israel, for the Israeli government, it's worth all the lives and damage.
Nathan Brown, a political scientist at George Washington University, takes a less cynical view.
I don't think that there's some kind of hidden collusion between Israel and Hamas, and the destruction in Gaza is just horrific. So I don't think anybody wants this to keep going on. But I do think what is true is that both sides are primarily playing to domestic public opinion.
Brown says both sides have strong incentives to keep fighting, and neither wants to be seen as the first one to back down.
Most people know how it's going to end with his return to the status quo ante.
And Brown says that means neither side will have advanced one millimeter. The dynamics of this conflict between Hamas and Israel will not have changed.
It's just a question of how much destruction is done until then.
For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
In other diplomatic news, the White House is hosting South Korea's President Moon Jae-in tomorrow. It will be the first top-level meeting between the two nations since Joe Biden became president. At the top of the agenda, North Korea and its growing arsenal of nuclear weapons. As the world's Patrick Wynn reports, the stakes at this meeting are very high, especially for President Moon.
No one can say that South Korea's president lacks ambition. Moon Jae-in has staked his legacy on getting one of the most notorious dictators on the planet to soften up, getting Kim Jong-un to be more open and flexible. A daunting challenge, though at times Moon has seemed to be pulling it off. That's President Moon hugging Kim Jong-un himself in North Korea while a huge crowd cheers. That historic embrace 3 years ago was a political high point for Moon. But now he's in his final year as president, and under South Korean law, he can't run again. He needs a serious breakthrough soon. Here's Robert Kelly, a professor at South Korea's Pusan University.
Most South Korean presidents try to tiptoe around the vortex of North Korea because it just sort of sucks you in and you never get out.
President Moon is deep in the vortex. He's focused on North Korea more than other big issues. Corporations run amok, housing prices, stuff South Koreans really care about. So he's got to walk away with more than just a hug.
미완의 평화에서 불가역적 평화로 나아가는 마지막 기회로 여기겠습니다.
Moon said recently, I see my final year in office as the last chance to go from an incomplete peace with North Korea to one that can't be reversed. Now, at this point, there's really one man who can make that dream come true.
Are we a nation that embraces dictators and tyrants like Putin and Kim Jong-un? We don't, but Trump does.
That was Joe Biden in campaign mode. Now that he's president, Moon will ask him to please take a leap and sit down with that dictator, Kim Jong-un. Professor Kelly says that Moon Jae-in and the South Korean left generally needs Biden to be bold because the U.S. and the two Koreas are stuck.
It's so ossified. It's this Gordian knot. And the way to sort of slice through that is to have a summit level meeting, which can be this breakthrough kind of silver bullet to reset the whole table.
It's a big request. But Moon got former President Trump to meet with Kim Jong-un 3 times, in part by playing to his ego.
Moon Jae-in is the one who told Trump that he might win a Nobel Prize, right? That's where Trump got the idea of winning a Nobel Prize from North Korea from, right? It was Moon Jae-in kind of whispering in his ear.
What did Trump get out of those meetings? Handshakes with Kim and photo ops. Not much else. And what has President Moon gotten for his trouble trying to broker peace between the U.S. and North Korea? Well, verbal abuse and lots of it. Kim Jong-un's younger sister and unofficial attack dog, Kim Yo-jong, she calls Moon a, quote, dreamy-eyed little boy. And to the Biden White House, she says, don't mess with us if, quote, you want to sleep well for the next 4 years. But Moon's administration just takes it because he wants big change, an official end to the Korean War, trade with North Korea, and eventually some form of unification. Professor Robert Kelly says the U.S. stands in the way of that vision.
They keep colliding with the reality of sanctions. The U.S. Treasury Department has to call up the Korean government every once in a while, every time Moon says we want to do this or that, and say you're not allowed to because it's illegal.
Moon needs Biden to take this risk, to wind down sanctions, which really do suffocate North Korea's economy, especially now when there's a bad food shortage. Kim Jong-un would love to get rid of those sanctions. That probably would bring him back to negotiations. The problem is that, unlike Moon, the U.S. is not focused on a possible grand peace with Pyongyang. It mostly cares about one thing, nukes, especially ones that could hit American soil. Biden recently said so himself.
I'm also prepared for some form of diplomacy, but it has to be conditioned upon the end result of denuclearization.
Now, almost no one thinks North Korea's regime will hand over its nuclear arsenal, which it calls a sword of justice, the only thing stopping America from invading. If anything, Robert Kelly says, North Korea might agree to stop building more warheads or even getting rid of some.
Maybe they'll roll back a little bit. We just have to talk to them. We have to engage them. Let's say they've got 400 weapons. Well, they don't need 400 weapons to threaten the United States.
Just 50 nuclear bombs would be plenty, he says. But will Biden risk his reputation to sit down with Kim Jong-un when, best case scenario, North Korea still gets to keep enough nukes to immolate L.A. or Houston? And worst case scenario, Biden gets played like a sucker. The American president is in no rush to meet the North Korean dictator, Kelly says. So President Moon's time may be running out.
I think that's what's going to happen. Moon is going to be remembered as a guy who took a huge swing. He was swinging for the bleachers with North Korea and he whiffed.
That may be a lesson for the next South Korean president if he or she thinks about taking a risk on courting North Korea. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. Young people in Germany won a landmark legal victory last month. They sued their government for not doing enough to tackle climate change, and they won.
This isn't about what satisfies me or anyone else, but this is about governments aligning the climate policies to the science.
That's one of the plaintiffs, Luisa Neubauer, on Sky News. The court told German leaders to come up with a more detailed plan of how it would cut greenhouse gas emissions in the coming decades, a ruling that those leaders themselves weren't expecting.
I think everybody in government was surprised.
What happened next is the focus of today's Big Fix.
Change is coming.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
What we do now will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
When the court ruling came down late last month ordering Germany to revise its climate law, the government snapped into action. Jochen Flossbart is state secretary at the Environment Ministry.
We in the Ministry of Environment saw that this is a great opportunity to come up with a new legislation and to follow what the court asked us to do.
Less than 3 weeks later, Germany's cabinet approved a new set of climate targets, a 65% cut in emissions by 2030 and net zero emissions by 2045. That's one of the deepest emissions reduction targets in the world, and it will require cuts across the board.
all the different sectors, like the energy sector, the industry sector, traffic and transport, agriculture, housing, all sectors have to deliver.
I asked Flossbart what the new plan means for coal, an important power source for German industry. He told me there was already a plan in place to phase out coal. The new targets will just speed that up.
We will have to do the transformation towards renewable electricity faster than we expected to do so, specifically as we are going to phase out nuclear energy by the end of next year, which makes it even more ambitious to run an economy like Germany, one of the biggest economies of the world, completely by renewable energy.
But in terms of cutting coal emissions, will it be a reduction of jobs? How do you actually cut coal emissions?
Well, we have already decided to phase out coal power plants the latest by 2038, probably by 2035. We also accompanied our decision with structural support for the respective regions. So we will invest a lot of money to give these regions and also the people, of course, in these regions a new perspective.
Does that mean retraining for new jobs? What does it mean to give them a new perspective?
Yes, this means training, of course, for those people working in specifically the coal mining, but also the coal facilities, but also simply to attract new industries to exactly come to these regions. And one of these regions in eastern Germany, for example, Tesla is at the moment building a huge facility for the production of electric vehicles and also for batteries.
At a European climate meeting this month, climate activists cheered Germany's new plan, but they were disappointed that Chancellor Angela Merkel did not announce increased funding for climate finance for developing countries. Germany's the fourth largest economy in the world. Do you think Germany should be doing more to help smaller economies adapt to a changing climate?
I think all countries, all developed countries have to do more, but I need to say that Germany has done a lot in the past. We have been financing the highest share of all industrialized countries, so we believe others have to jump in now as well. In the future, we'll pay a fair share of the whole amount.
Germany has one of the most ambitious plans in the world now when it comes to lowering carbon emissions. What do you think Germany can teach the rest of the world about balancing difficult trade-offs and doing what's necessary to decrease emissions?
Maybe the most relevant part to learn is that we should have started earlier. The cost would have been lower of this transformational process.
Jochen Flossbart is the state secretary at Germany's Federal Ministry for the Environment. He's been speaking to us from Berlin. Thanks a lot, Jochen.
Bye-bye.
In Ireland, they're now seeing something that hasn't been seen in 300 years, a pair of cranes nesting in a bog. That's cause for big celebration there. Mark McCory is the lead ecologist at Bord na Mona, a company that owns the peat bog where the cranes were spotted. He joins us now. Mark, two cranes spotted in a bog in the Irish Midlands, apparently nesting or preparing to breed. Why is this such a big deal?
It's really exciting for us because these birds haven't been seen breeding in Ireland for about 300 years. They unfortunately went extinct back then because of hunting, and we haven't seen them breeding since then. So we do occasionally get these birds appearing in the wintertime, but it was really exciting to see a few birds appear in one of our bogs in the springtime and then starting to display and starting to build a nest. Unfortunately, we haven't seen any chicks yet, but we're really excited about this year because the birds actually came back. These are migratory birds, so they disappeared off the nest site for the wintertime, but really exciting that they've come back.
So what do these birds look like? I mean, how big are they?
They're very big, and they're very big in an Irish context because in Ireland, we don't have that many big birds. So they would be about 4 foot high. You're talking nearly 6 foot wingspan. And this is nearly twice the size of the hern, our biggest wetland bird, which is about 2 foot high. And so if you saw it on a bog or in the distance in a wetland, it would be obvious that it's a crane and it's something really unusual.
I understand that this is a huge deal because cranes feature so prominently in Irish mythology and history. Tell us a little bit about that.
If you look at the Book of Kells, there is a wetland bird or a water bird featured in that with a long neck and a red patch on its head. So the monks that drew the Book of Kells at that time were familiar with cranes, and seemingly the cranes were revered when they were present in Ireland, and their nesting places were considered sacred spaces. We see evidence of that because in some of our lakes, we still have islands that refer back to the crane, and they would be called corps, which is the Irish word. It's associated with the crane.
This particular pair that have appeared on this peat bog, I understand the peat bog had been re-wetted or rehabilitated by your company, Bordnamona. What does re-wetted mean?
Bordnamona are the Irish state company that produce peat, and we were to produce peat for energy to be generated into electricity. And that's because in Ireland, we didn't have many resources such as coal or even such as timber, but we did have a lot of bogs. So we developed our peatlands back at the, you know, at the start of the Irish state. Obviously, to harvest peat, you need to drain it. And now we're reversing that process. It means that the remaining peat stays in the ground and it's not leaking carbon into the atmosphere. And it's fantastic for biodiversity. And the appearance of the crane is just a great example of that.
Have you seen these two cranes?
I haven't seen these two cranes. We're being particularly cautious about, you know, not trying to go down and disturb them too much. But I'm really looking forward to getting out and watching them. Seeing birds like this in their natural habitat is just fantastic.
Mark McCory is the lead ecologist at Bordnamona. It's an energy company in Ireland that used to produce peat and now produces renewable energy. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Carl.
You're listening to The World. As the U.S. military operation winds down in Afghanistan, there's growing concern about allies left behind. Many Americans say we're abandoning Afghans who helped America.
I would love to see a mass evacuation of all of those who worked with our forces and, you know, who are in danger of being murdered by the Taliban.
That's coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Today in Reykjavik, Iceland, nations with land in the Arctic held their biennial summit. And there was a clear buzzword.
We have a duty to strengthen our cooperation.
Our cooperation based on international law.
Constructive cooperation.
Our cooperation is based on common interests.
This cooperation is the language of the North.
Those are foreign ministers from some of the 8 Arctic nations, as well as representatives of indigenous Arctic communities. They met today to work together towards sustainable development in one of the fastest changing regions on the planet. The World's environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler has more.
Since Biden became president in January, his administration has signaled America's return as a partner on the global stage. This Arctic Council meeting continued the trend. The council was formed 25 years ago to foster cooperation in the region and includes Russia, the U.S., Canada, and Scandinavian countries, as well as indigenous communities.
We're committed to advancing a peaceful Arctic region where cooperation prevails.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken stressed the need for cooperation as global warming increases competition for thawing sea routes and oil reserves in the Arctic.
The Arctic is more than a strategically or economically significant region. It's home to our people. Its hallmark has been and must remain peaceful cooperation.
Blinken also named the climate crisis as a priority for the council. Wildfires, permafrost melt, and changing habitats are impacting the lives of the Arctic's 4 million residents, 1 in 8 of whom are indigenous.
The Arctic, as others have noted, is warming at 3 times the global average, which adds even greater urgency to our efforts.
These comments seemed almost a direct response to a speech made on the sidelines of this event 2 years ago by Blinken's predecessor, Mike Pompeo. Pompeo called the Arctic an arena for power and competition. He said the council no longer had the luxury to focus on scientific collaboration, cultural matters, and environmental research.
We're entering a new age of strategic engagement in the Arctic, complete with new threats to the Arctic and its real estate and to all of our interests in that region.
Many people noted the pivot at the meeting, including the president of Inuit Circumpolar Council Alaska, James Stotts.
After a slight setback,
The Council has returned to its original objective of trying to balance sustainable development and protection of the environment. Thankfully, global climate change is once again back on the agenda.
Foreign ministers for the 8 Arctic nations also signed a declaration, something they do every 2 years.
It may take a couple of more minutes than it usually does.
They walked to a podium one by one to sign the document.
And giving time to disinfect the signature pens in between.
This seemingly bureaucratic step marked a significant return to the status quo. At the last Arctic Council ministerial, for the first time ever, the body didn't produce a signed declaration despite spending months on drafts. Julia Gorley was the lead U.S. negotiator on the document at the State Department at the time.
The Trump administration was not happy with the very few mentions of climate change that were in that document, and they were very vanilla, but it, for whatever reason, didn't satisfy. The Trump administration and Secretary Pompeo chose to not join the consensus.
This year's declaration calls on Arctic member states to name ambitious new targets for cutting greenhouse gas emissions and to work to reduce soot and methane emissions from oil and gas extraction in the region. Edward Alexander, head of delegation for Gwich'in Council International, called it righting the ship of cooperation in the Arctic.
For all of us to agree that we have climate change to contend with, and climate change is mentioned in this declaration, it's very key. And so it's very important that the declaration was signed as a renewed commitment towards protecting the Arctic.
On the sidelines of the meeting yesterday, Secretary Blinken met with his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov. Amid significant tension over issues like cybersecurity, Blinken identified climate change as a topic of possible cooperation for the two countries. Former State Department official Julia Gorley again.
This puts the U.S. with an exclamation point right back at the table in the Arctic Council.
Russia took over today as leader of the council for the next 2 years. The country has been increasing its military presence in the Arctic for the past several years. Foreign Minister Lavrov today said he wanted a seat back at the table during conversations about security in the region. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
As Russia has been building up its military capabilities in the Arctic, the Scandinavians have been keeping close watch. Katarzyna Zisk is following all of this. She's a professor of international relations at the Norwegian Institute for Defense Studies. I asked her to explain what the biggest issues are when it comes to security threats in the Arctic.
The opening of the Arctic, especially since the turn of the millennium, the growing international interest for the region has been, in a way, heating up the geopolitical tensions. There is a growing interest in using this new opening maritime space by the various militaries. And in fact, Russia, as a very significant, even dominant Arctic nation, has been generating a lot of this geopolitical and security attention.
What kind of military buildup has Russia done in the Arctic, specifically?
Russia has focused intensely on rebuilding its military infrastructure in the region. The strongest focus is on the European part of the Arctic, where Russia has the Northern Fleet, which is the strongest part of the Russian Navy. And then Russia has the largest share of nuclear submarines. So nuclear deterrence is number one. But on the same time, Russia has also modernized the conventional capabilities, also with the focus on the European part of the Arctic, but also expanding its presence along the Russian Arctic coast and on the Arctic islands.
It's interesting because if you read articles, say, in Sweden, you read things about how they're beefing up their military, how they're concerned about Russia as this kind of new threat. What's going on there? How are they viewing this?
You know, Sweden is one of the countries bordering Russia, which are very concerned by this increasing military capability and combination of the increasing military might of Russia with the willingness to use the military force. Sweden has been an object of various Russian influence campaigns over the past few years, and there has been also tension between these two countries, which is quite different from the relations between Russia and Norway, for instance.
Russia and Norway are cooperating more along the Arctic?
Yes, absolutely. Russia and Norway has quite an extensive cooperation encompassing, for instance, border guards cooperation, search and rescue, cooperation on managing the quite rich and well-managed fish resources in the region. So this cooperation has been ongoing. There has been, in general, quite good atmosphere, you can say. But of course, the military and security part is more problematic.
Do you ever worry about a kind of a mistake, an untimely military mistake that could happen up in the Arctic, given the amount of materiel up there?
Absolutely. There is a lot of and an increasing military activity taking place in the Arctic. And, you know, combined with the increasing tensions between these various stakeholders in the region, there is absolutely a possibility for inadvertent escalation. And this has been a scenario we've discussed for a number of years, that some kind of misunderstanding, for instance, concerning fishing. Russia has very extensive fishing activity in the region, including around the Svalbard archipelago, which belongs to Norway, which could get out of hand, out of control, or some military, for instance, plane going down on, and there could be a misunderstanding, especially in the climate of mistrust and tensions between these various stakeholders, especially Russia and NATO. So I think this is definitely a scenario that has been worrying policymakers in the various capitals in the Arctic.
Katarzyna Zisk is a professor of international relations at the Norwegian Institute for Defense Studies in Oslo. I want to thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
In Somalia today, political leaders from across that nation came together to kickstart talks over an election. It was scheduled for months ago, but never happened. The World's Halima Gikandi has our story.
Today, the who's who of Somali politics are gathered in the capital, Mogadishu. Government officials, opposition party members, and presidential candidates, too. They're meeting to finally resolve a months-long election dispute that has put the country on edge. A few weeks ago, rival militias and government soldiers tied to opposition leaders openly clashed with forces loyal to President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed. He goes by President Farmaajo for short. This was a real low point for Somalia, says Omar Mahmoud. He's an analyst with the International Crisis Group.
Part of the issue this time around was the political crisis also morphed into a security crisis. And so the disputes you had around politics, around the election, then very much became infused within the security sector.
Opposition leaders were upset that presidential and parliamentary elections that were planned for February 8th never happened, mostly because Somali politicians were not able to agree on all of the terms of the vote. President Farmaajo then decided to extend his time in office by 2 years. But after violence broke out in the capital, he backed down. Now he's tasked Somalia's prime minister, Mohamed Hussein Roble, with bringing the parties back to the table. This month, Prime Minister Roble reached an agreement with opposition leaders to get armed forces out of the capital city. He told them not to get involved in politics. Omar Mahmoud, the analyst, says that while the security situation has improved, it's only a temporary solution. The original disagreements over how to hold the election are unresolved.
There was a breakdown in terms of how the different parties, you know, particularly the federal government and some of its member states, wanted to go about implementing it in a few particular areas of concern that rose up.
In particular, who will sit on electoral commissions at both the national and state level? Somalia's elections are indirect. That means local clan leaders select delegates to electoral colleges, which then select members of parliament, who then select the president. It's far away from the one person, one vote that many were hoping to see this time. This would have been the first direct election in Somalia in decades. Again, here's Omar Mahmoud.
The direct model just really wasn't feasible within the timeframes. I mean, it raises questions, you know, whether it's going to be feasible in the future to go from this big jump or whether something more gradual is actually more appropriate.
In an op-ed this week, President Farmaajo suggested he's not to blame for the election dispute. He said he wants to put electoral power in the hands of the people, not clan elites. That's his explanation for extending his term by 2 years in the first place. But opposition leaders called it a power grab. The crowded Eastleigh neighborhood of Nairobi, Kenya, is known as Little Mogadishu because of the large number of Somalis that live here. I spoke with Sufyan Said Mohammed, a 30-year-old teacher from Somalia.
As a Somali, I care more about the country, peaceful election, stability, and defeating al-Shabaab. That's the main important. Even I don't care about the democracy, one man, one vote.
One man, one vote, he says, is not a priority for him. He just wants to see stability in Somalia, which continues to be plagued by terrorist attacks from the al-Qaeda-linked extremist group al-Shabaab. The group controls large swaths of territory in central and southern Somalia, and there are fears that al-Shabaab will take advantage of the current political crisis and expand its influence. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
For an island nation, Madagascar is the world's second biggest after Australia. And right now, a huge part of the south side of the island is in crisis. The region is facing its worst drought in four decades. More than a million people in Madagascar are facing acute food insecurity. My colleague Marco Werman spoke with Arduino Mangoni with the World Food Program about this. He's based in the capital, Antananarivo. Marco asked Mangoni how bad this current drought has been.
This crisis in the south of Madagascar is unprecedented. And in the last 5 years, there has been a string of droughts. And once again, this year, harvest has been lost. Around 1 million people is on the brink of famine, especially the kids.
Have you or any representatives from the World Food Program been there on the ground in southern Madagascar? And what have you seen?
I have been several times, the last time being 2 weeks back. I was exactly in Ambobombe, the heart of the crisis. I have never seen kids in a status of malnutrition as severe, as acute as the kids in the south of Madagascar. They are literally bones and skin, and I have never seen in my life anything similar. And what struck me is the rate, the percentage of kids in that situation, including their parents. We were told by the people in the villages that some of them had left, moving towards the urban centers along the coast. This is a very indicative and serious sign of people not being able to survive anymore in their villages of origin.
So what do you pinpoint as the cause of this crisis?
Well, there's a combination of factors. First of all, Madagascar is one of the poorest countries on earth. Around 74% of the population live below the poverty line of $2 per day per person. And this percentage goes up to 90% in the south, which is the region which is mostly affected by chronic droughts.
And so it's a real grim combination of factors. Studies have also linked Madagascar's prolonged droughts to climate change. So if those studies are correct, that would mean this pattern of drought and famine could get even worse. So how can greater resilience be created in communities that could be facing more drought in the future?
Yeah, this is probably the biggest challenge. From our perspective, access to water is key. In the medium term, communities also need access to seeds for them to be able to plant as soon as the few sporadic rains will come in the coming months. Building resilience in that part of the country, this is a critical challenge that all actors together need to address.
What has the coronavirus done in Madagascar to the effort to get aid to those people in the south?
The biggest challenge is in accessing Madagascar because the international flights and internal ones have been shut down. So it is difficult for the humanitarian personnel to reach Madagascar. And when they do so, it takes 3 days by road to reach the south. So this is the key impact from the coronavirus on the ability of the international community to respond to this crisis.
What are the UN and the World Food Program actually asking for right now?
Looking at the next lean season, which will probably start a bit earlier this year, on average, I'm talking about rough figures, we will need around $15 million per month.
$15 million per month.
$15 million USD per month to reach around 1.2 million people with daily food and nutrition rations for the kids for the entire lean season between September and March 2022.
That was Arduino Mangoni with the World Food Program speaking from Madagascar's capital, Antananarivo. He was speaking with my colleague, Marco Werman. Imagine stepping outside your home and finding a letter that calls you and your family traitors who will be killed. Many people in Afghanistan received those threats because of their work for the U.S. military. Now, as the U.S. leaves Afghanistan, there's a growing push to prioritize the safety of these Afghans. Here's Texas Representative Michael McCaul at a congressional hearing last week.
We owe a moral responsibility to them to get them out of there.
The World's Monica Campbell has been following this story and how one Afghan family is holding on to the hope for a safer life. And a note, we're only using middle names for some people to protect their security.
Mustafa was asleep at home in Afghanistan when the letter arrived. It was handwritten on a white sheet of paper. Speaking in Pashto through an interpreter, Mustafa says the letter was posted to the wall, and its message was clear. It read, "If you are caught, you will all end up dying like your father, down with the spies and puppets of America." Days before, Mustafa's father, Mohammed, was gunned down. Mustafa believes it was the Taliban. For more than a decade, his father worked for the U.S. as an interpreter and advisor. Mustafa is the oldest son. He's 20. And he admired his dad's work, even hoped to follow in his footsteps. "I believed the U.S. mission would help my country move toward peace," Mustafa says. But for years, his dad's work triggered threats from groups like the Taliban. And for years, his dad sought a safe life for his wife and kids through a special U.S. visa program. It's for Afghans who've helped American forces. The visas can take years to process, though. Mohammed was killed just as his visa was finally nearing approval. "The U.S. government was negligent," Mustafa says. "Visa delays cost my dad's life." The family is hoping to receive permission soon to enter the U.S. away from the threats they still face. Stories like this are convincing more U.S. politicians to demand an end to the backlog of pending visas for Afghans. There are at least 17,000 of them, with tens of thousands more potential applicants.
"We cannot allow Afghanistan to be another Saigon."
Texas Representative Michael McCaul spoke at a congressional hearing this week on Afghanistan. He was referring to a scramble to get local allies out of Vietnam at the end of that war.
"Many will die if the administration doesn't act quickly and safely speed up the visa processing to get these people out before we withdraw."
The Biden administration is now reviewing the visa program. A State Department spokesman says more staff is working on the visas, but would not confirm how many. Advocates would like to know more. Julie Kornfeld is a lawyer with the International Refugee Assistance Project, a nonprofit. She worked on Mohammed's case.
"I don't know how many more additional staff that they sent to Kabul, but it would have to be quite a hefty number.
A hefty number to make a real dent in the visa backlog ahead of September, when the U.S. plans to complete its withdrawal from Afghanistan. So some advocates are calling for a bold action, a mass evacuation of Afghan allies at risk.
"Similar to what we have seen in Vietnam, in Iraq, in the Balkan Wars, most specifically in Kosovo."
Chris Purdy is with Veterans for American Ideals. He says people could be evacuated to Guam, perhaps, where the U.S. took refugees during previous wars before admitting them into the United States. Purdy estimates about 70 to 80,000 Afghans would need to be airlifted out.
"That number is jarring for a lot of people. And a lot of people will hear that and throw their arms up in the air and say, oh, it can't be done. But the fact is we have, and we did it 50 years ago. If we could do it after Vietnam, we can certainly do it now."
The Biden administration hasn't commented on evacuations yet, but in that congressional hearing this week, Zalmay Khalilzad, a special representative for Afghanistan, pushed back on an organized evacuation of Afghan allies.
"We don't want to signal panic and the departure of all educated Afghans by worst casing and undermining the morale of the Afghan security forces. So this is a delicate, complicated balance that we have to keep."
Many Afghans were studying to be doctors and teachers before going to work alongside U.S. troops. They spoke English. These were skilled professionals foreign forces needed on the ground. Mustafa, whose dad was killed, is a university student himself. "I'm studying math," he says. He hopes to continue his studies in Houston. That's where the family will go if they receive permission to enter the U.S., because of support offered by a veterans group in Houston called Combined Arms. It's raising cash to help the family resettle. I asked Mustafa what he plans to take with him to the U.S., assuming his family makes it there. He paused for a long time before answering, then spoke through tears. He says, I will take some soil from my father's grave. For the world, I'm Monica Campbell.
One way to slow the spread of the coronavirus, don't hold singing events. But what if singing is what your event is all about? That's Malta's submission to this year's Eurovision Song Contest. It's happening right now in Rotterdam in the Netherlands. To cut down on infections, Eurovision organizers are using COVID breathalyzers on thousands of attendees.
It's really great to have something that's really late in the late stages of research and that's being used for now.
Kevin Lamote researches breathalyzer technology at the University of Antwerp. He says early results look promising and expects breathalyzers to become widespread in the coming year.
And other tools will be available on the market, which will be more specific and which can be used very faster and have a result within seconds.
Anne Wiley describes the use of breathalyzers at Eurovision as sort of a real-time experiment, par for the course over the past year, really. Wiley is a diagnostics expert at Yale University's School of Public Health.
So much of what we've been doing throughout the pandemic already, you know, we've had to take approaches that we hope or think or, you know, even assume, you know, base it on previous experience and really hope that it's going to work in the larger settings as well.
Wiley says while PCR tests are the most accurate, breathalyzers could be good for events like Eurovision. Less reliable, but immediate results, providing some comfort that your fellow concertgoers are safe. Wiley says she applauds Eurovision organizers for trying the breathalyzers. Still, she's not quite ready to attend the event herself.
I would definitely be hesitant going into a crowd like that just based on my, you know, just how the past year has been and just, you know, slowly re-emerging.
If you're not ready to go to Eurovision either but love the tunes, we've got good news for you. We'll tell you about it tomorrow on The World. We come to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. See you on Friday. From PRX.